Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Philip Yun, Executive Director of the Plowshares Fund, and your moderator for today's program. This program is also being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East Forum. And now I am pleased to introduce our distinguished speaker, Hossein Mousavian, former foreign policy advisor to the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, visiting research scholar at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, and author of The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, a Memoir. Ambassador Mousavian's book is the first detailed account from an Iranian perspective of the events between Iran and the West since 2002, when Iran's secret nuclear-related activities came to light. From reading his book, it is clear that Ambassador Mousavian is a defender of Iran's nuclear program. Ambassador Mousavian was for many years a prominent Iranian government official and diplomat. Some of his government positions included serving as the Iranian ambassador to Germany in the 1990s, as well as spokesperson for the Iranian nuclear negotiating team from 2003 to 2005. He also was arrested by the government of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad on charges of espionage in 2007, and the ambassador talks about this episode in his book. It is safe to say, therefore, that Ambassador Mousavian has an insider's perspective on Iran and its policymakers. Indeed, in light of current events, including talk of a possible Israeli strike on Iran, it becomes critical for us in the U.S. to better understand what the Iranian government is thinking and why, if we are to do all that we can to figure out an acceptable non-military solution to this nuclear impasse. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ambassador Hossein Mousavian.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for me, an honor for me, to be with such a distinguished guests tonight. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers of this meeting, George, Ricky, and also thank Philip for moderating the program. I would like to talk about maybe 25 minutes on Iran-U.S. relations and the nuclear issue, which is the most critical issue between Iran and international community. As the head of Foreign Relations Committee of Iran National Supreme Security Council 1997 to 2005, I'm fully convinced that Iran is not after nuclear bomb. And the elimination of weapons of mass destruction and the establishment of a zone free from such weapons in the Middle East are important elements of Iran's national security doctrine. Nevertheless, Iran's nuclear program has remained the number one political dilemma of the U.S. for past decade. 9 years of negotiations between Iran and the P5+1, five permanent members of United Nations Security Council plus Germany, known as P5+1, on nuclear issue has failed and would likely continue to do so as long as hostilities between Iran and the U.S. persist. With a dismal track record, the international community and Iran have once again returned to negotiation table over Iran nuclear program. In the past months, they have held talks in Istanbul, Moscow, and Baghdad, which have created momentum with very little in substance. While the U.S. has already begun economic, political, cyber, and covert war with Iran, it's conceivable that the U.S.-Iran relation will reach a turning point within a year on the nuclear issue. Without substantial progress on the diplomatic front, the chance for a unilateral Israeli or a joint U.S.-Israeli military campaign aimed at destroying the Iranian nuclear program could become a probability. It's therefore critically important for a better understanding of Iran-U.S. dispute on nuclear and weapons of mass destruction in an effort to reorient the current diplomatic trajectory. First, the first question is, how did we get here? In pre-revolution era, Western countries were competing to win lucrative projects to nuclearize Iran. Since the U.S. had close relations with Iran and decided to lay the foundation of a nuclear Iran. In this period, the nuclear technology for Iran was essential and justified. In 1976, Gerald Ford, the then U.S. president, signed a directive according to which Iran was supposed to have a complete nuclear fuel cycle. The Ford strategy paper said introduction of nuclear power will both provide for a growing need of Iran's economy and free remaining oil reserves for export or conversion to petrochemicals. The United States and Europe had no objection to enrichment plants inside Iran, despite the fact the Shah had ambition to acquire nuclear weapon. When the Shah was asked by a French journalist in 1974 whether Iran would pursue a nuclear weapon, he replied, "Certainly, and sooner than one would think." After India tested a nuclear device that same year, he said, "If other nations in the region acquire nuclear weapon, then perhaps the national interest of any other country will demand the same." I'm convinced that if the Shah were alive today, Iran would have many nuclear power plants. The U.S. proposed Iran to have 23 power plants by the year 2000. This was the U.S. proposal in mid-1970s for Iran. I'm convinced if the Shah were alive today, Iran would have many nuclear power plants, industrial-scale uranium enrichment facilities, and that Iran's nuclear arsenal would be on par with those of Pakistan, India, and Israel. After Revolution 1979, Iran remained committed to NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty, and decided to shrink ambitious nuclear military projects of the Shah. In response, the West withdrew from all nuclear agreements and contracts, sanctioned and isolated Iran. This was mainly to the hostilities between the U.S. and Iran. Nevertheless, this event forced Iran to go for self-sufficiency, to finish billions of dollars of unfinished projects, which Iran had already paid to Western countries, like France and Germany and the U.S. Furthermore, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, and the U.S. and the West unfortunately supported the aggressor. And his use of chemical weapons against Iranian civilians, where tens of thousands of Iranians, they were either killed or injured. This event also changed Iran's security calculations. Right after Iran mastered enrichment technology, Iran's nuclear case came under the spotlight in 2003, and the IAEA Board of Governors issued the first resolution on Iran's nuclear program. Since 2003, and after 4,000 man days of IAEA's inspection of Iranian nuclear facilities, the U.S. and its allies generally agree on three things about Iran's nuclear program. First, Tehran does not have a nuclear bomb. Second, Iran has not decided to build nuclear bomb. And third, probably years away, Iran is years away from having a deliverable nuclear warhead if decide to develop a nuclear bomb. Nevertheless, they believe that Iran intends at least to acquire the capability to build nuclear weapon. The capability is the question. In a relatively short time, should it deem them necessary. And as a result, they do not trust Iran will confine its nuclear activities to non-military purposes. This is the question. In reality, Iran's nuclear program is a subsidiary issue of Iran-West relations, specifically Iran-US relations. While Iran-US relations also is a subsidiary issue of Iran-Israel issues, conflict between Iran and Israel. Since countries like India, Pakistan, and Israel enjoy strategic relations with the U.S. and the West, even though they are not members of non-proliferation treaty and possess massive arsenal of nuclear weapons. Where is the problem and what can be done? On the nuclear issue, talks between Iran and EU3, Germany, France, and the UK in 2003 to 2005 failed because the US was not on board. Agreements between Iran, Turkey, Brazil in May 2010 failed because of the US objection. Russian step-by-step proposal in summer 2011 failed because the US declined. Even the recent talks in Istanbul, Baghdad, Moscow failed because the U.S. was not ready to compromise on two major issues in response to Iran's overture. First, recognizing the legitimate rights of Iran under NPT, non-proliferation treaty, and gradually lifting the sanctions. That's why I always have advocated a realistic dual-track policy. First, a bilateral talk between Iran and the U.S. on a comprehensive package, including all bilateral, regional, and international issues, a direct talk between Iran and the U.S. The second track between Iran and the P5 plus one on the nuclear issue. This is the two track I believe we need to be held in parallel. Otherwise, Iran's talk with the P5 plus one would not work. On Iran-US talks, despite harsh rhetoric, President Ahmadinejad had reached out to the U.S. more than all previous Iranian presidents since 1979. Because he had a freer hand toward rapprochement with the U.S. During this time, he has written letters to both presidents, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, including congratulating the latter on his electoral victory in 2008, while the U.S. counterparts have never responded to him. During the first presidential period, 2005-2009, Ahmadinejad's top advisor, Hashemi Samere, met with William Perry, the former U.S. Defense Secretary and two U.S. congressmen, in a roundtable meeting in organized by Pugwash in European capital. Gary Seymour, who is currently Obama's top advisor on terrorism and proliferation issues, and the Iranian ambassador at the IAEA also participated in the talks. Right after the Iranian presidential election in 2009, Ahmadinejad sent a message to Barack Obama via Mohammad al-Baradei, the former head of IAEA, that Ahmadinejad wanted direct talks with the United States and is ready to cooperate and help the U.S. in Afghanistan and elsewhere. This was the message. In October 2009, the highest level talks ever held between American and Iranians took place between U.S. Undersecretary Bill Burns and Iran's top nuclear negotiator, Saeed Jalili. President Barack Obama also made some unprecedented diplomatic gestures toward Iran, raising hopes that the animosities that have plagued U.S.-Iran relations for the past three decades might be overcome and rapprochement achieved. President Obama's call for engagement without precondition and threat was a first for any American president since Iran's 1979 revolution. Hence, Obama's initial gesture were met with positive sign from Tehran. Obama sent two letters to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who responded. In addition, the two administrations have quietly encouraged track one and a half track dialogue, in which high-level former U.S. officials met with current Iranian officials. Not just once, maybe about 10, 15 meetings. Despite these unprecedented efforts by both presidents, engagement has failed thus far and will continue to fail as long as both sides undermine it with dual-track approaches. Official statements and now diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks show that since early on in Obama's tenure, even as the administration spoke of rapprochement, the U.S. continued the Bush administration's policy of increasing pressures on Iran through new sanctions, hinting at a readiness to take military action and supporting covert sabotage of Iran's nuclear program. During Obama's engagement policy, the U.S. has taken the toughest policies to date against Iran, the most far-reaching sanctions legislations in the history of Iran-U.S. relations by Congress, securing four United Nations Security Council sanction resolutions, specifically Resolution 1929, as the most comprehensive sanction the international community has ever approved against Iran. The U.S. Navy ordered all units under its command to relabel the Persian Gulf as the Arabian Gulf. Sabotage against Iran's nuclear program through spying and covert actions. Orchestrating international pressure on Iran to impose additional unilateral sanctions beyond the realm of the current UN sanctions. U.S.-led sanctions against Iranian oil industry is costing $133 million a day. Following the congressional election in 2011, the director of Tel Aviv-based Middle East Economic and Political Analyst Company called on incoming Republican members of Congress to support President Obama's Iran policy because he said, Obama has done more to undermine Iran over the course of 2 years than George W. Bush did in 8 years. In response to the U.S. dual-track policy, the Iranian leader noted, they say that they have extended their arm toward Iran. What kind of hand? If it's an iron hand concealed with a velvet glove, then it will not make any good sense. These actions have made the Iranian side believe that Obama's talk of engagement with Iran is just talk, and have also raised the cost for the Iranian side to approach the U.S. for rapprochement. Iran, meanwhile, has pursued a dual track of its own. Ahmadinejad has sabotaged his engagement policy with inflammatory rhetoric that has antagonized the U.S. and its allies, questioning the Holocaust, suggesting that the terrorist attack of 9/11 were a U.S. government conspiracy and that Israel must be erased from the page of history. Such rhetoric has also increased the political cost tremendously for American politicians if they were seen to be soft on Iran. This approach has been counterproductive, the dual track, and has left an impression in Tehran and Washington that the other side has no real interest and intention in thawing relations. Therefore, due to dual-track approach, both sides are confused about whether engagement is for the other side a strategy or a tactic. The second main problem is piecemeal approach. Iran is after a comprehensive deal with the U.S. to be sure that the entire game plan, including the end goal, before committing itself to anything. Iran is asking for a grand bargain, including the nuclear issue. The U.S., on the other hand, is suggesting a piecemeal approach. Iranians have experienced such policy for the last three decades with no success. Due to past experiences, I believe we need a mixed approach, which I would introduce. To revive relations between Washington and Tehran, the following principles can facilitate a constructive engagement policy. The measures which I propose Tehran and Washington, they take at least during engagement policy and negotiations. First, dual-track approaches are seized for the period of negotiations. Second, the language of threats and harsh rhetorics is set aside. Third, hostile actions, sanctions, and other forms of coercive pressures are put on hold. To agree on a comprehensive agenda, this is what Iran wants, including all bilateral, regional, and international issues, demonstrating the entire game plan, but implementing through a phased approach plan. This is what the U.S. wants. This is the mixed approach. A comprehensive package implementing in phased approach. This is the way out. Issues of common interest are given priorities in the talks. Iran and the U.S. have common interest in many strategic issues vital to their national interests, like security and stability of Afghanistan and Iraq, combating Al-Qaeda terrorist networks, and preventing drug trafficking. Such a skillful approach would be only possible if and when Tehran and Washington can isolate internal and external spoilers. The framework on nuclear dilemma. On the nuclear issue, Iran and P5+1 can agree on a face-saving solution where Iran would adhere to all international nuclear conventions and treaties at the maximum level of transparency defined by the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, to ensure the peaceful nature of Iranian nuclear activities and also to ensure international community that Iranian nuclear program would remain forever, not only peaceful, Iran would be committed forever to be a non-nuclear weapon state. In reward, the U.S. would also agree to recognize the legitimate rights of Iran under NPT for enrichment and to lift the sanctions gradually. This framework can be realized in future nuclear talks through a step-by-step plan based on NPT, mutual confidence building, and appropriate reciprocity, as agreed in Istanbul talks in April 2012. And the last point, to ensure a long-term sustainable solution, the United Nations Security Council, in cooperation with regional powers, should proactively pursue the elimination of weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East. This is the best and sustainable, durable solution for all Middle Eastern countries. I would be ready, Philip, for the questions. Thank you.
Our thanks to Ambassador Hussein Mousavian, former foreign policy advisor to the Iran Supreme National Security Council, visiting research scholar at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, and author of The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, a Memoir. And now it's time for audience questions. We've got a number of them, and they cover a wide range. Let's start with something, at least to get you started in this, is a question that a couple of people asked about why you wrote the book. I thought it would be good to open with this in the Q&A session because people can clearly understand what your perspective is. You're an Iranian nationalist. You're no great friend of President Ahmadinejad, but you're not a dissident either. And you're part of a moderate group, I think some people would say, and an advocate for Iran's nuclear policy. Can you tell us the motivation then of why you thought it was important to write this book and talk with people about it?
In Iran, they know, Philip, I have been advocating for 30 years good relation between Iran and the U.S., Iran and the West. The problem is the lack of understanding in both sides. Americans, they do not understand Iran. Iranians, they do not understand America. The second major problem is mistrust. But mistrust is mutual. Americans and Western countries, they need to understand why Iran cannot trust the West. They have their own legitimate reasons. Like Americans and Western countries, they cannot trust Iran. And Iranians also, they should understand why. Being here, I thought maybe the most important job I can do to write a book on the nuclear issue, as far as the nuclear issue is the issue number one for the U.S. and international community, to present the way, the perspective and point of view of the Iranians for American public opinion and politicians to facilitate a possible peaceful solution for Iranian nuclear crisis.
Okay. There are a number of other questions, and you allude to this, related to trust. What do you say to those Americans who argue that Iran, a deal with Iran is really useless, that the Iranian government cannot be trusted and cannot be relied upon to fulfill its promises? And there are other people who say that a deal with Iran is not possible because the Iranian regime is irrational, bent on dominating the Middle East and committed to defeating the West. And they point to President Ahmadinejad's outrageous comments on Israel, the Holocaust, 9/11, as well as Iranian ties to terrorist groups. I think part of this also goes to, in a certain way, does deterrence work related to Iran? And can you talk about that?
You hear a lot on interviews, op-eds, reports. They are always talking about Ahmadinejad's statement on Holocaust and wiping Israel off the map. Although Ahmadinejad himself said this has been completely misinterpreted. Although the Deputy Prime Minister of Israel just 2-3 months ago had an interview, Prime Minister Netanyahu, a minister of Israeli ministers, said, from the beginning we knew Ahmadinejad has not made such a statement, and this was misinterpretation. Whether this was true or not, this is another issue, but the fact and the reality is the U.S. policy since Revolution 1979 has been based on regime change. It doesn't matter we have had 8 years moderate president like Rafsanjani or a reformist president like Khatami or a conservative or radical president of Ahmadinejad. The policy of the U.S. has been regime change. Therefore, we should not deceive ourselves to just confine the period to discuss the period of Ahmadinejad and his rhetoric on Holocaust or Israel. This has been the constant policy of the U.S. If you studied the U.S. policies toward Iran, you would see continuous increasing of sanctions and pressures, even during the moderate presidents like Khatami and Rafsanjani. This is the issue. I understand, Philip, a lot of people, they say there is no use to trust Iran. And in Iran also, they say there is no use to trust the U.S. This is exactly the same. Iranians also, they have their own justification. They say we had democratically elected prime minister in 1953. The U.S. made a coup d'etat and bring a dictator. They say the U.S. supported 25 years, a quarter of a century, a dictator, Shah, in Iran. They say the U.S. is not true about democracy because they were supporting dictators. They say the U.S. supported Saddam Hussein for invasion of Iran. And even the U.S. provided chemical weapons and technology for Saddam Hussein to use against Iranians, which is true. I mean, they have their own justification, and Americans also, they have their own justification. Americans also, they would talk about hostages in 1979. Americans, they would talk about American embassy bombing in 1982, and they have, both of them, they have a long list. But my point is this. Iranians, they have approached the U.S. during all administrations for a comprehensive package and comprehensive deal. When you read my book, you would see that I have explained during three top nuclear negotiators since 2003, during President Khatami and Ahmadinejad, both. All three top nuclear negotiators, they have sent a message for White House that we want grand bargain with you. We want a comprehensive deal and relation with you, including the nuclear. But the U.S. has declined. The United States has never proposed Iran a comprehensive package. Never. My point is this. First, try at least once. I really don't care in Iran whether we have conservative or moderate president or reformist, because I have been working for 16 years under Rafsanjani and Khatami, and I know we did our utmost to bring the relation, to improve the relation with the U.S., and the U.S. always declined. Therefore, this is the same policy during Ahmadinejad. I mean, but they can use, they have better justification during Ahmadinejad. They use Holocaust and all these rhetorics, which is very harmful for Iran's national interest. My suggestion is this. Any U.S. administration, I hope after election, because we cannot talk before election, propose at least once after 33 years a comprehensive package, including terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, peace process, Israel, human rights, democracy, all these major points for the U.S. And Iranians also, they have their own shopping list. And the U.S. also should be prepared to address Iranian concerns. If it failed, then come to your public and say it doesn't worth to try. Because you have never tried. The U.S. has never tried.
I've been asked to make this reminder for our listening audience and radios. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Ambassador Hussein Mousavian, former foreign policy advisor to the Iran Supreme National Security Council, who is providing his perspective on the impasse with Iran. We had a number of questions related to Israel and a military strike. And in a recent op-ed, you gave 20 reasons not to attack Iran, and you were quite explicit calling a military strike idiotic. Tell us some of the reasons why you think this is the case, and do you fear that a strike can happen within the next 6 months or so?
I don't want to see the U.S. as a warfare country. I really don't like it. I really don't know what the U.S. gained attacking Afghanistan and Iraq. Trillions of dollars. Thousands of Americans, they lost their lives. Tens of thousands of Afghanis and Iraqis, they lost their life. What was the excuse? Weapons of mass destruction. It was a lie. Who did it? I don't know. War on terror against Al-Qaeda and Taliban. After 10 years, now the U.S. is doing its best to negotiate with Taliban how to manage Afghanistan. If it was your objective, you could do it at the beginning. I mean, I really don't understand what the U.S. could gain after two wars. This is exactly the reason I see this would be a disaster for the U.S., for Iran, for Israel to go to the fourth war against Muslim country in the region. First of all, if the target is an Iranian nuclear program, it may delay. But you would never be able to remove Iranian nuclear technology because this is homemade. They have technology, they have knowledge, and if you destroy one facility, they would build it tomorrow another facility. This is not the way. And I think that the main loser would be Israel. Already Israel is isolated worldwide. And another war pushed by Israel, I believe, would create more hateness toward Israel. America and Israel, they are doing their best to introduce Iran as threat number one in the Middle East. I understand why they are doing their best. For me, I understand. But a poll by Arab Institute covering 86% of Arab countries in 2011 shows by a ratio of 15-1, it means 94% of Arab people, they consider the U.S. and Israel as the number one threat. Only 5%, 6%, they consider Iran. Are you going to win the nations? This is how Arab streets and Muslims, they are thinking about the U.S., This is what I don't like it. I want to bring a major change to the mindset of 1.5 billion Muslims toward Americans and America.
As a follow-up, do you think there can be peace between Iran and Israel?
Here is the crux of the matter, I believe, is more hostilities between Iran and the U.S. would bring more hostilities from Iranian toward Israel. Israelis, they are doing their utmost to create more hostility between Iran and the U.S. They are pushing the U.S. toward the war, but they do not understand that this would create more hostilities toward Israel. I believe rapprochement between Iran and the U.S. is the only way to modify Iran's position. And I really do not see any other alternative.
So in that sense, you think that it is possible that it is a possibility that Iran at some point could recognize Israel's right to exist?
Philip, the recognition of Israel is not Iran issue. Almost majority of U.S. allies in the region, like Saudi Arabia, also they do not recognize Israel. I mean, why you are always talking about Iran, why you are not talking about the U.S. allies? They do not recognize Israel, majority of them. We have 57 countries, Muslim countries. How many of them they recognize Israel? More than 50 they do not recognize. Or at least majority, they do not. I don't know exactly the numbers, But I'm convinced, 100% I'm sure, the majority, which they all have even good relations with the United States, they do not recognize Israel. Recognition of Israel is not Iran issue. It's an issue with all Muslim countries, with 1.5 billion Muslims. I think Netanyahu's policies is the major problem for peace process, not Iran policies. If Netanyahu was really rational, he would have cooperated with President Obama on two-state solution. He is blocking the two-state solution. If he was cooperating with the U.S., with the U.S. president to bring the two-state solutions, and if Iran was going to disturb this agreement, then you could claim Iran is guilty.
Okay. There are a number of questions related to intent. You stated at the beginning of your remarks, as well as in your book, your belief that Iran is not attempting to acquire a nuclear bomb, that Iran's nuclear intentions are completely peaceful. But Iran has repeatedly failed to be transparent about its activities and in many cases arguably has misrepresented them. What is Iran trying to achieve by being so defiant? And again, as a follow-up, you talk about the difference between making a decision to create an operational nuclear weapon and having the capacity to produce a nuclear weapon. Are they not one and the same?
I believe 80% of reality is related to nuclear talks between P5 plus one and Iran has not been discussed in U.S. media, the realities, the facts. That's why the U.S. public opinion, they are unfortunately deprived from the realities. In February 2010, the head of Iranian Atomic Energy Organization, which now is the foreign minister, Mr. Salehi, proposed the P5 plus one to provide fuel rods for Tehran Research Reactor, which is a reactor built by Americans and is used for isotopes for 800,000 patients struggling with cancer. They need fuel rods to continue to run this nuclear facility. Iranians proposed that we would not increase the level of enrichment beyond 3.5% if the U.S. and the P5 plus one provide the fuel rod for Tehran. In order to build the fuel rod, you need to increase enrichment to 20%, then to build the fuel rod. Without 20%, you cannot build the tool. It was Iran proposed the U.S. and Europeans that we do not want to have high-level enrichment. We want to stay below 5%. We don't want to have 20%. Just give us the fuel rods. The Western countries, they declined. Iran had no other option to increase the level of enrichment to 20%. When you read the stories about Iranian nuclear issue today, the core issue is 20%. Iran has enriched up to 20%, therefore they want to make nuclear bomb. This is the story you read everywhere. But they don't tell you the truth. In September 2011, Iranian foreign minister and president, they came to New York here for United Nations Assembly, and they proposed the U.S. and the West. They said, now we have 20%. We are ready to stop. We are ready to go back to 3.5%. If you provide us the fuel rod, because about 1 million patients with cancer, they need it. Then they said they declined. It was Iranian proposal to stop 20%, to go back to below 5%. As long as enrichment is below 5%, there is no danger of any nuclear weapon at all. Everybody knows. Then Iran had to build its own fuel rod to run this TRR, Tehran Research Reactor. But Again, in summer 2011, the Russians, they brought a proposal, Philip, to table. It was, I personally was shocked how Iran welcomed this proposal. Because Russians, they proposed for Iran to implement additional protocol and subsidiary arrangement code 3.1. Many of you, maybe you don't know what is these protocols, but just to brief you, if a country accepts these two arrangements, this would be the country would be committed to the maximum level of transparency which internationally exists. Tens of countries, they have not been ready to sign additional protocol even today. Because signing additional protocol, you have to give access even to your military sites. Many countries, they hesitate. This was one part of, and these two issues is the major requirements of the United Nations Security Council and Atomic Energy Organization resolutions. The major requirements on transparency is for Iran to accept these two, additional protocol and subsidiary arrangement code 3.1. Another element of this proposal was for Iran to be committed not to exceed enrichment beyond 5%. Keep its enrichment activities always below 5%. The other element was to give 100% transparency, not based on additional protocol, even more. Here I was shocked when I heard Iran has given positive signal. To address possible military dimension known as PMD, IAEA has some question about possible military dimension of Iranian nuclear facilities. They say PMD. To address PMD issues, which IAEA requires, Iran has to give access beyond additional protocol. I mean, those access which no single country in the world is ready to give to the IAEA. Unlimited access with no restriction, beyond additional protocol, beyond NPT. The other element was for Iran to have only one enrichment facilities. Iran already has two and has announced would go for 10, because to build 20 nuclear power plants proposed by the U.S., you would have to have many enrichment facilities. The Russian proposal was for Iran to have only one. Russian proposal required Iran to stop developing new generation of centrifuges. All these activities are legal by NPT, all legitimate and legal. At the end of the proposal was for Iran to suspend its enrichment for 3 months. I personally was shocked how Tehran has given a green light to P5+1 to accept such a proposal, which would give access to the IAEA beyond NPT, beyond additional protocol, unlimited access, to have only one enrichment, to stop new generation of centrifuges, all these restrictions. But Iran's foreign minister publicly said Iran is positive toward the initiative and is ready to discuss the details. But immediately the U.S. and the Europeans, they rejected the Russian proposal. My argument is that at least this proposal could be a base for negotiations. This is the fact, Philip. I mean, even today, on the negotiation table, American team, they know very well, and I can guess State Department is also very much willing to go for such a deal, but you know the position of Congress. They don't want the U.S. president to recognize the rights of Iran for enrichment. This is official statement of the Congress. If Iran is supposed to be member of NPT, if Iran is supposed to be member of international community, there should be no discrimination. This is the legitimate rights. Why Europeans, they have enrichment up to 96%, and Iran cannot have enrichment below 5%. The reason for supporting Iranian nuclear rights, because this is not a matter for Ahmadinejad. This is an issue of national pride and consensus in Iran. No matter we have conservative president, reformist president, even clerics or Shah, this was exactly the red line of Shah, the U.S. allies. Shah was also emphasizing on the rights of Iranian nation under NPT. And this is exactly what the current nuclear negotiators, they are emphasizing. They don't want anything more than their rights, like any other member of NPT. If the U.S. is prepared to accept, then you would see Iran would open all doors for transparency, cooperation, to give all assurances that this country would remain as non-nuclear weapon state.
So following a short follow-up question, then, it seems to me that the right to enrich and peaceful use of nuclear energy is a matter of principle for Iran. And the question here was saying, as a practical matter, would Iran consider, or are they considering, alternative energy sources, solar or others, that may somehow be part of any kind of solution? Is there
of course, Iran would welcome all sorts of energies, but do you mean that Iran would accept to be deprived from the rights on their NPT for peaceful nuclear technology? No. If those are making these arguments, Iranian nation would never accept to be discriminated or singled out. It is impossible.
The next set of questions had to do with the policymaking process and very loosely what I call who's in charge. Can you talk more about the Iranian policymaking process? Who has the final say? There's considerable confusion, I think, among the audience, I would think, and others particularly, and others in the United States, about the role of the president, whether it be Ahmadinejad, Rouhani, or Khatami, on one hand, and Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, and the mullahs. So can you give us a better sense of, who can speak for Iran and under what circumstances? And then there's a larger question about the competition that happens, because I think in Iran it's not a monolith. There are a lot of different factions. How does that play into all of this?
If you compare Iranian constitution with American constitution, you would see 95% of authorities of Iranian supreme leader is like U.S. president. Here the U.S. president ultimately should have the final say on foreign policy, which in many times he cannot. Like engagement policy with Iran, he failed because he couldn't deliver. In Iran, the ultimate decision maker by a constitution is supreme leader. But it has a process. We have foreign ministry, presidency, we have National Security Council, which the Speaker of Parliament, Head of Judiciary, Foreign Minister, Defense Minister, Interior Minister, they all are there. And they discuss the issues, and they decide. Then they send the decision for the leader to approve. If the leader approves, they can implement the policy. If he rejects, they cannot implement the policy. But in order to understand Iranian decision-making process, look, during our time, when I was a part of nuclear negotiation team in 2003 to 2005, all nuclear policies we had, we decided to implement additional protocol voluntarily. We decided to implement subsidiary arrangement voluntarily. We decided to give access to the IAEA to military sites voluntarily. Even we decided to suspend uranium enrichment for a while as a confidence-building measure, but voluntarily. Although Iranian leader personally didn't like none of these policies, But he did not reject it, because this was National Security Council decision. At the same time, during Ahmadinejad, they decided to stop additional protocol. You see, completely different policy during two administrations. And during our time, the leader accepted our proposal. During Ahmadinejad time, also the leader accepted. Although, from the beginning, he believed as much as we cooperate more with IAEA and with the West on nuclear program, they would increase pressures more and more and more. Because they want, he was telling us that they only want to deprive Iran from its rights for enrichment. They are not sincere for transparency. They know we don't have nuclear weapon. They know we don't want nuclear weapon. But they do not want Iran to have enrichment. That's it. That's why he was telling us that's why they are after suspension. And still this is the Western policies. Their core request from Iran is suspension.
Let's talk then, or move to the negotiations themselves and components of that. You've talked a lot about that already. I found it really interesting in your book. You talk about the current deadlock on the nuclear issue as the result of two miscalculations. And one on the part of the United States and the Europeans, and one on the part of powerful factions in Iran. You also talk about how both sides have learned their lesson. Would you elaborate and inform our audience on both of those points?
Yeah, during our time, a very powerful fraction in the country believed that the Western, the U.S., European threats for referring Iranian nuclear file to United Nations Security Council is just a bluff. We knew this is not bluff. We knew they would do it. The reason they were saying it's bluff, because they were telling us, look, we are cooperating with IAEA. IAEA frequently has reiterated that there is no evidence of diversion. We are a member of NPT. We don't have nuclear bomb. Why they should refer the case to United Nations Security Council, and why they should sanction Iran? There is no reason for it. But we knew the issue is political. It's not legal. Legally, they were right. But politically, they couldn't understand. This was a big problem, and they believed we are intimidated, or even we are cooperating with the Western demands, but our real objective was preventing Iran from referring to Security Council and sanctions while defending the rights of Iran. Okay, they changed the policy and they understood this was not a bluff, because the case immediately was referred in 2005, when they 2005-2006, when they restarted enrichment plan facilities. The case was immediately referred to United Nations Security Council, although Iran had no bomb and had no decision to make bomb. From the other side, our European counterparts, they had something in their mind which they were hiding from us, but I could read the nuclear negotiation team, they could read. We were telling them that if you think you would be able to bring Iran to a final cessation of its nuclear program through prolongation of suspension and negotiation, you are wrong. It's not going to happen. If Iran has accepted to suspend for a short period, this is for a short period, non-legally binding and just for confidence building. No one in Iran would be able to deprive the nation from its rights. But they had in their mind, because of the U.S. pressure, prolong the negotiations and ask Iranian to suspend as long as negotiation continues. When they brought the first European package, the three European ambassadors they brought to me, as I explained in my book, in August 2005, before Ahmadinejad took office, I saw it was a 10-11 pages proposal with good incentives. I just checked one point, the suspension. They asked in that proposal for Iran to suspend for the period of negotiations, full stop. I asked him, what do you mean by this? Period of negotiations, 1 month, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, one century. What's this period? They said, you know, Ambassador, at least for 10 years. I mean, immediately after the leader read the notes of this meeting, he said, look, this is what I told you from the beginning. You should not trust them. They are lying. And then they decided to start enrichment without, I mean, not through negotiations. This was a miscalculation in the European side. And we had also within our country a miscalculation that the case would not be referred to United Nations Security Council. I believe, Philip, now they have learned lessons. Americans and Europeans, they understand, regardless of who is ruling Iran and the amount of sanctions and pressures, Iranians would not give up their rights while they are saying, reiterating, emphasizing that we do not want bomb. Iranians also, they have understood pressures, sanctions are serious, and this is not just a bluff. This is the best time for both, after these lessons, to sit together, for the U.S. and Europeans to propose Iran a list of transparencies, objective guarantees for non-diversion of its nuclear program toward military purposes, a list of measures for confidence-building measures. Whatever this list is, they know how to prepare such a long list. In return, to respect the original rights of Iranian nation under NPT, and if Iran accepts transparency measures, confidence-building measures, give the 100% transparency for its enrichment program, stay under 5%, and all these confidence-building measures, then gradually lift the sanctions. Okay. Because the sanctions only are penalizing the Iranian nation, the ordinary people. And I always keep to say, Iranian nation are maybe the only nation or among very, very, very limited nations which they like relation with the U.S. and they like Americans. Why you are penalizing this nation?
Okay, we have time for just one last quick question, 1 minute. And this evening, for those of the people here in the audience and those listening on television and radio, what do you want them to take away from your remarks here this evening? We have about 1 minute. What would you like them to take away from this, from your remarks?
To end the hostilities. 33 years of hostility between Iran and the U.S. is enough. I believe enough is enough, really. Do we want to continue these hostilities for another 33 years? It doesn't work. This is my main message.
Okay. Our thanks to Ambassador Hussein Mousavian.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Ambassador Hussein Mousavian, former foreign policy advisor to the Iran Supreme National Security Council, visiting research scholar at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, and author of The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, a Memoir. We also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind you that copies of Ambassador Mousavian's book are on sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to sign them in this room immediately following the program. This program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East Forum. I'm Philip Yun, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.